Well, American conservatism has undoubtedly suffered steep ups and downs in the post-World War II period. Today, liberal pundits and historians are at it again. They are saying that in the wake of last November's election, American conservatism is headed for the ash heap of history.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. I'm George Gillum, the chair of the forum. Lee Edwards and I have been friends since the early 1960s. So when I was looking for the very best person to discuss the prospects for conservatism in the light of the 2006 and 2008 elections, it was easy to turn to Lee Edwards. Lee is widely recognized as the leading historian of the American conservative movement. Lee Edwards did his undergraduate work at Duke, and he earned his doctorate at Catholic University and did additional graduate work at the Sorbonne. His principal perch is and has been at the Heritage Foundation, where he's the Distinguished Fellow in Conservative Thought at the B. Kenneth Simon Center for American Studies. He also teaches at the Catholic University of America, and he's published 15 books, including biographies of Ronald Reagan and of our mutual friend Ed Meese, as well as the official history of the Heritage Foundation. He was the founding director of the Institute on Political Journalism at Georgetown University and has been a fellow at the Kennedy School. No stranger to public service, Lee Edwards serves as chair of the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, which has created a memorial at the intersection of Massachusetts and New Jersey Avenues in Washington, a memorial to the more than 100 million victims of communism. And on a personal level, he and his wife, who is also his chief collaborator in his writing, have 7 grandchildren. We're especially grateful that Lee has chosen to be here at the Miller Center today while the Conservative Political Action Conference is taking place in Washington. I would compare this to Tiger Woods deciding to play putt-putt during the Masters tournament. Please welcome Lee Edwards.
Well, George, that was a wonderful introduction. As a matter of fact, why don't you just keep on talking? I mean, you've got this audience really warm and feeling good, and golly, here I'm going to be up here talking about dull things like conservatism for the next half hour or so ago. And thank you so much, George, for that very wonderful introduction. And it's always a pleasure to be here in Charlottesville. My wife and I know it because our daughter Elizabeth got her PhD here at Virginia, and working under Whittle Johnston. And I don't know whether any of the more senior members remember Whittle Johnston or not, but he was a great scholar and was a great mentor to Elizabeth. And we're always wonderful to get back to Charlottesville. So, are we at the end of conservatism? Is it a burnt-out case? Do we hear solemn bells tolling in the distance? Well, let's begin our discussion with a little history. 45 years ago, Lyndon Baines Johnson won the presidency in a landslide, receiving 61% of the popular vote, carrying 44 states, for a total of 486 electoral votes. And his coattails were long and wide. Democrats wound up with a 2-to-1 majority in the Senate and the House of Representatives, which is the largest Democratic majority in the House since the high point of the New Deal. Johnson swept every geographical region except the Deep South, every voting group except Republicans. In the 108 history of the Republican Party, only 2 presidential candidates received a lower percentage of the popular vote than Barry Goldwater's 38.5%. John C. Fremont, who was the GOP's first standard bearer back in 1856, and Alf Landon, FDR's ill-fated opponent in 1936. The political historian Theodore White concluded that the elections of 1964 had left the Republican Party in desperate condition. And because Goldwater had run a defiantly conservative campaign from beginning to end, most political experts were quick to second White's bleak assessment of Republicanism and go him one better with regard to the state of American conservatism. Walter Lippmann, the preeminent pundit of the day, wrote that the returns disprove the claim that there is a great latent majority of conservative Republicans who will emerge as soon as the Republican Party turns its back on Me Too-ism and offers them a choice. Author-journalist Robert J. Donovan said that if Republicans are seen to be the voice of right-wing radicalism, they will remain a minority party indefinitely. And the New York Times' James Reston summed up that Barry Goldwater not only lost the presidential election, but the conservative cause as well. Well, of course, as you might suspect, conservatives adamantly dismissed any such doomsday analysis. Ronald Reagan, fresh from his widely hailed national television address on behalf of Goldwater, wrote that the landslide majority did not vote against conservatism, but against a false image of conservatism that our liberal opponents successfully mounted. Frank Meyer, the political astute senior editor of National Review, pointed out that despite the caricature of the conservative cause as extremist, radical, nihilist, anarchic, two-fifths of the voters voted for the conservative alternative to liberalism. Meyer's implication was clear. You can build a powerful political movement on a foundation of 27 million true believers. So, who proved more correct in their assessment of the returns, Walter Lippmann or Ronald Reagan? Reviled and rejected in 1964 as no other presidential candidate in the 20th century, one magazine cover screamed that Goldwater was psychologically unfit to be president, that is, crazy. Barry Goldwater was easily reelected to the US Senate in 1968, while the president who buried him in an historic landslide dared not seek reelection. The primary cause of Johnson's ignominy was the Vietnam War. The war that Johnson had promised he would not send American boys to fight. The war that ended with over 58,000 Americans dead and 303,000 wounded. By early 1968, conservatives were grimly joking, "They told me if I voted for Goldwater, we would go to war in Vietnam." Well, I did, and damned if we didn't. Looking back, I think we can see that the 1964 election and the passage the following year of the Great Society marked the apogee of modern liberalism. A sharp reaction set in a year later when the Republican Party, led by Goldwater conservatives, gained 47 seats in the House of Representatives, 3 seats in the Senate. The Democratic losers were almost without exception supporters of LBJ's Great Society and Vietnam War policy. Let's jump ahead. 15 years after the so-called Goldwater debacle, Ronald Reagan announced that he would seek the Republican nomination for president. The immediate reaction of the punditocracy was that Reagan was too old. He was nearly 69, too conservative, and too dumb to be president. How could anyone who had hosted a TV program called Death Valley Days cope with the multifaceted responsibilities of the leader of the free world? The New Republic characterized Reagan as an ex-movie actor, darling of the rabid right, international innocent, and economic extremist. Sociologist Robert Coles, a very distinguished sociologist indeed, called the prospect of Reagan winning the GOP nomination preposterous. Well, James Conaway wrote in the Atlantic Monthly that among the news media, the idea of Reagan as president was more than they could bear. Yet, a decade later, when President Ronald Reagan left the White House, historians and politicians poured forth a stream of encomiums about his presidency, citing the restoration of Americans' confidence in themselves, the impressive economic recovery, the end of the Cold War at the bargaining table and not on the battlefield. Summing up his presidency after his death, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Edmund Morris said, "We know his greatness as a president by what we don't see today. Where is the Soviet Union? Where is the double-digit inflation? Where is the national malaise?" On foreign policy, remarked Democratic Senator Edward M. Kennedy, "He will be honored as the president who won the Cold War." Still, not everyone sang his praises. The Reagan legacy, said Nobel Prize economist James Tobin, was a crippled federal government. And CBS's Morley Safer said, "I don't think history has any reason to be kind to him." So, who was more correct in their assessment, Morley Safer or Ted Kennedy? Well, American conservatism has undoubtedly suffered steep ups and downs in the post-World War II period. Indeed, it seemed on the edge of extinction after the crushing defeat of Goldwater in 1964, after Reagan's failure to capture the Republican presidential nomination in 1976, and after Bill Clinton's third wave victory in 1992. But each time, conservatism rose from the ashes like the fabled phoenix. Today, liberal pundits and historians are at it again. There they go again. Amnesiac as ever, they are saying that in the wake of last November's election, American conservatism is headed for the ash heap of history. And they're joined by some confused conservatives who mistake the Republican defeats of 2006 and 2008 for repudiations of conservative ideas. The country is no longer America the conservative, asserted senior editor John Judas of the New Republic, but America the liberal. Barely able to contain herself, the editor of The Nation trumpeted that the election of Barack Obama marked the collapse of conservatism. Barack Obama's victory signaled more than the end of an era of Republican presidential dominance and conservative ideology, said Michael Lynn, one-time conservative. It may mark the beginning of a fourth republic of the United States. Lynn's conclusion that the era of conservatism was ended and America was at the beginning of an era of Hamiltonian centralization and reform was seconded not only by euphoric liberals, but by anxious conservatives ready to chart a new course, even if uncertain about the destination. Here are a few examples. Former Republican Congressman Mickey Edwards, no relation, has called for a return to the libertarian philosophy of Barry Goldwater. The villain behind the collapse of conservatism, he says, was the coupling of big government conservatives and that great boogeyman, the religious right. Author-commentator David Frum insists that the key to political success is big government conservatism that would provide health insurance for all and rebuild our armed forces so that we can crush terrorism. Former Bush speechwriter Michael Gerson states that we need compassionate conservatism to combat global AIDS, combat U.S. poverty, and promote human rights abroad. Saying that conservatism without idealism is dead, he lists his heroes: William Lloyd Garrison, William Jennings Bryan, Martin Luther King Jr., and John Paul II, a quartet that is yet to make an appearance at the annual Conservative Political Action Conference or the Southern Baptist Convention. Well, commentator Patrick J. Buchanan, as always, ready with that sharp comment, lambasts arrogant neoconservatives and greedy Wall Streeters for leading us astray, and sets forth an America First platform. At the other end, Cato's David Boaz invokes a plague on both big government conservatives and liberals and says that choice is the key, whether you're choosing a church, a school, or a lifestyle. Now, the journalist Ryan Sager comes closest, perhaps, to a sensible prescription when he urges a renewal of the fusionism first set forth by Frank Meyer, but then says that the old formula needs reworking. Well, I suggest that what is needed is not a casting out of social conservatives or neoconservatives or any other kind of conservative, but the creation of a new fusionism that will unite all the branches of the now divided conservative mainstream. I believe that a new fusionism will be able to do that, although I freely concede it will be no easy task. But by blending the concepts of liberty and order, individual freedom and responsibility, limited government and a strong national defense, to do so just as the founding fathers did with the checks and balances of the Constitution. Frank Meyer, the author of the original fusionism and an avowed libertarian, stated that the core principle of his theory was that the freedom of the person is the central and primary end of political society. The state has only three limited functions: national defense, preservation of domestic order, and the administration of justice between citizens. But Meyer argued that religious and traditional precepts were needed to undergird freedom, which could not exist on the relativist, materialistic premises of modern thought. He said that liberty was linked to American religion because it was the source of ethical choice and a unique byproduct of Western faith. What all the brave new proposals by conservatives that I've mentioned here lack is an understanding of the history of modern American conservatism. How has conservatism survived these crises that I've mentioned for more than 50 years, and each time emerged with renewed strength and momentum? Was it luck? Divine intervention? Well, I believe in providence, but I also believe in free will. Was each conservative recovery simply part of the pendulum that Arthur Schlesinger Jr. has suggested dominates American politics, swinging left for a generation or two, then right, then left again, ad infinitum? Or is the continuing success and durability of American conservatism due to the conscious acts of individual men and women operating on certain fundamental principles over the course of the last 60 years? Here, I believe, is the central reason for the viability of the conservative movement, guided by principles such as limited constitutional government, free enterprise, and traditional American values based on our Judeo-Christian heritage. The movement has been fortunate, I might even say blessed, to have been led by a remarkable group of philosophers, popularizers, politicians, and philanthropists. First came the men of ideas, and for any movement, that's where you start, with ideas. First came the men of ideas, intellectuals and philosophers like Friedrich Hayek, the Austrian-born classical liberal, Russell Kirk, the Midwestern traditionalist, Whitaker Chambers, the one-time communist spy turned anti-communist champion. Next came the men of interpretation, the journalists and the popularizers, like the polymath William F. Buckley Jr., the columnist and television commentator George Will, the radio talkmeister Rush Limbaugh. Last came the men of action, the politicians and policymakers. led by what I call the four misters. Mr. Republican, Senator Robert A. Taft of Ohio, Mr. Conservative, Senator Barry Goldwater of Arizona, Mr. President, Ronald Reagan, and Mr. Speaker, that Georgia Congressman Newt Gingrich. But the philosophers would not have been able to write their books, and the popularizers would not have been able to publish their magazines, and the politicians would not have been able to run their campaigns without the support of conservative philanthropists, men of means and vision, such as Sun Oil Company's J. Howard Pugh, who gave the Intercollegiate Studies Institute its first $1,000. The Colorado beer baron, Joseph Coors, whose $250,000 investment enabled the Heritage Foundation, for which I work, to open its doors. And California oilman, Henry Salvatore, who put up much of the money for Ronald Reagan's TV address for Barry Goldwater. Now, the conservative ascendancy was also helped by the decline and fall of American liberalism, which lost its way between the New Deal and the Great Society, between Korea and the Sandinistas, between populist President Harry Truman and elitist presidential candidate Al Gore. Starting in the 1960s, liberals went into freefall, their swift descent marked by a telltale shift from a concern for the common man and middle America to preoccupation with minorities and special interests. Conservatives triumphed in the 1980s and the 1990s when their movement contained all the elements necessary for political success: a clearly defined, consistent philosophy, a broad-based national constituency, a sound financial base, proficiency in the mass media, and charismatic, principled leadership. They were also helped by a sixth factor, an atmosphere of crisis. We have to acknowledge that. Certainly in 1980, Americans were sharply aware the nation required leaders who could cope with the critical problems facing us at that time, like inflation, unemployment, and the Soviet Empire. In 1994, the people demanded that something be done about out-of-control government programs like health care and welfare. But life in this target-rich environment had unintended consequences, and this must be admitted. Some Americans began to believe that government was always the problem. Antipathy and then antagonism spread, affecting everything from voter turnout to respect for government as an institution. Conservatives were obliged to explain that they were for limiting, not eliminating, government. Some Americans concluded that conservatives, in their rush to wipe out 50 years of welfareism, apparently did not care what happened to people who were dependent on welfare. Neoconservative William Crystal asked a pertinent question: how can Americans love their nation if they hate its government? Government does have its legitimate purposes, he argued, but then overcompensated by urging a revival of national greatness conservatism modeled on the example of Theodore Roosevelt. As the political historian and my colleague Matthew Spaulding has pointed out, TR is a problematic choice, since Roosevelt's new nationalism called for an activist state with strong regulatory powers, a goal at cross purposes with modern conservatism. While some conservatives might find Roosevelt's brand of vigorous leadership refreshing, Spaulding said, a better and more recent statesman to emulate is Ronald Reagan. Well, it certainly is beyond dispute that conservatives miss Reagan. Starting in 1989, traditional conservatives, libertarians, and neoconservatives have been feuding and fussing like so many Hatfields and McCoys. They miss the soothing presence of Ronald Reagan and the unifying threat of communism. As soon as the Berlin Wall came down, conservatives began building walls between one another. Soon there was open talk of a conservative crack-up. Violent disagreements erupted among conservatives over trade, immigration, and the direction of U.S. foreign policy. However, following Bill Clinton's 1992 victory, conservatives began constructing a coalition of economic free marketers, anti-government Perot supporters, remember Ross Perot, and believers in conservative family values. The last group, the social conservatives, turned out in many ways to be the most important. Despite the consecutive presidential triumphs of 1980 and 84 and 88, conservatives discovered yet again that man does not live by politics alone. They found themselves agreeing with Judge Robert Bork that American popular culture is in a free fall with the bottom not yet in sight. So this present spirited debate about the future of conservatism among conservatives is a sign not of decay, but of vitality. Even sharp disagreement can strengthen a movement as long as the disagreements are based on principle and not driven by a desire for personal aggrandizement. So, where is conservatism headed? Well, as I have said, certain elements are necessary for a successful political movement. To begin with, it must have a clearly defined, consistent philosophy. It's a given that conservatives of all stripes honor the Constitution and its established system of checks and balances. They agree that government should be limited, individuals should be free and responsible, and there can be no lasting liberty without virtue, public and private. Both Adam Smith and Hayek were in agreement about that. These ideas are not just conservative ideas, but American ideas that have their roots in the founding of the Republic, and which, according to the Rasmussen Report and other surveys, are endorsed by a majority of the American people. Last October, for example, the Terrence Group reported that 57% of Americans call themselves somewhat conservative or very conservative, while just 35% consider themselves somewhat liberal or very liberal. A Rasmussen survey at about the same time underscored American skepticism about government, reporting that 59% of voters agreed with the statement that government often is the problem and not the solution. And there are a number of conservative scholars, young and old, who are committed to explaining and exploring the conservative philosophy. Present-day conservative intellectuals include Robert George of Princeton, Harvey Mansfield of Harvard, Charles Kessler of the Claremont Institute, Hadley Arkus of Amherst, and your own James Caesar here at the University of Virginia. Next, a political movement must have a broad-based and broad-minded national constituency. Now, granted that conservatives are independent, individualistic, they like to argue about ideas and institutions with friends as well as adversaries, they're uncomfortable with compromise and scorn accommodation, but they have come together and stayed together when the times required it and when the right leadership managed it, as with Robert Taft in the 1950s, Barry Goldwater in the 1960s, Ronald Reagan in the 80s, Newt Gingrich in the 90s. Next, a political movement must have a sound financial base. Well, thanks to technical proficiency and political success, the number of conservative donors has grown exponentially from a few thousand in the 1950s to more than 5 million today. The fiscal strength of conservative organizations is impressive. The combined annual budgets of the 16 most influential conservative organizations, including Heritage, ISI, Media Research Institute, total $544 million, more than $500 million. And then there are the center-right foundations, whose assets totaled $7.4 billion, including the Big Six, Templeton, Scaife, Bradley, Noble, Amway, Castle Rock, and another 37 foundations across the country. Next, the political movement must be media savvy, familiar with and expert in the use of the latest in mass communications. Now, here there's a paradox. Conservatives have displayed mistrust, anger, and contempt toward the mass media for decades. Yet, the number one columnist in America, measured by the number of newspapers that carry his column, is conservative Cal Thomas. In addition, a bevy of young writers like Ann Coulter, Michelle Malkin, Jonah Goldberg have written best-selling books and are in frequent demand as TV commentators. With 150,000 subscribers, National Review, edited by Rich Lowry, has the largest circulation of any journal of opinion in America. The number one talk show host is Rush Limbaugh, who has a weekly audience of over 15 million. The number two radio host is conservative Sean Hannity. Indeed, of the top 10 talk shows, 8 are hosted by conservatives such as Michael Savage, Glenn Beck, Laura Ingraham, and Neil Bortz. In the cable world, Fox News leads CNN in audience ratings, thanks to such commentators as Bill O'Reilly and Glenn Beck. The O'Reilly Factor has been number one in its time slot for 85 consecutive months. The Fox network has been the number one cable news network for 7 years. Which brings us to the fifth element of a political movement, charismatic principle leadership. True, today for the first time in 60 years, there is no undisputed conservative leader. No Taft, no Goldwater, no Reagan, no designated successor like George Herbert Walker Bush in 1988 and George W. Bush in 2000, both of whom sorely disappointed conservatives. But there are many rising and already visible political stars in the conservative firmament, such as Congressman Mike Pence, Paul Ryan, and Tom Price, who's chairman of the Republican Study Committee, Senators John Cornyn, Tom Coburn, Jim DeMint, chairman of the Senate Steering Committee, Governors Sarah Palin, Bobby Jindal, and Mark Sanford, chairman of the Republican Governors Conference. With leadership, much of the frustration and uncertainty that characterized the conservative movement at present will fade away, as it did when Taft, Goldwater, Reagan, and Gingrich were the acknowledged leaders of conservatism. When the day comes, as it will, when the conservative movement unites behind the right leader and puts him on course to perhaps enter the White House, the question will be raised, and it should be, can conservatives govern? It's a reasonable question, given the glaring missteps and failures of the Bush administration, from the major deficits and record federal spending to the unrealistic goal of building a democracy in Iraq overnight. Well, the answer is simple. Of course conservatives can govern. Examples. 1947, a Republican Congress under the leadership of Senator Taft passed the Taft-Hartley Act, which redressed the excesses of FDR's labor relations legislation, instituting, among other provisions, the right to work without union membership in the states. That same Congress, the so-called Do-Nothing Congress, helped lay the foundation for the successful foreign policy of containment, a policy which kept the Soviet Union at bay for 40 years. Jump ahead to 1981. The Reagan administration overcame the opposition of a Democratic House and passed the Economic Recovery Act, which cut marginal tax rates across the board, prepared the way for a period of unprecedented economic recovery lasting more than 20 years. In 1996, a Republican Congress under House Speaker Newt Gingrich passed, over President Clinton's veto, welfare reform, which substituted work for welfare and enabled the states to reduce their welfare rolls by as much as 33%. Well, the liberal historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. wrote way back in 1947, quote, that there seems no inherent obstacle to the gradual advance of socialism in the United States through a series of New Deals. 5.5 decades later, the conservative columnist and commentator George Will wrote that we had experienced the intellectual collapse of socialism. The one political constant throughout these years was the rise of the right, whose path to national power and prominence was interrupted by the death of its leaders, calamitous defeats at the polls, constant feuding within its ranks over means and ends, and the hostility of the prevailing liberal establishment, but through the power of its ideas, linked by the priceless principle of ordered liberty and the successful political application of those ideas, the conservative movement became a major and often dominant player in the political and economic realms of our nation. So it was, and so I suggest it is in these times of crisis and doubt and fear, when conservative values are urgently called for. Values like prudence, not rashness, custom, not the impulse of the moment, a transcendent faith, not a fatal conceit, reform, not revolution. So as we seek solutions to problems that seem sometimes almost unsolvable, we should recall the wisdom of T.S. Eliot, who reminded us that no great cause is ever wholly lost because no great cause is ever wholly gained. Thank you.
Let me ask the first question, Lee. What happened in 2008? Was the 2008 election a referendum on the governance of President Bush? Was it a rejection of the questionable conservatism of McCain? Or was simply the time right for somebody with Obama's extraordinary gifts to come along? Or was it some combination of all?
Well, I think all of the above. It was all of those things. And I think really, once the economic crisis had arrived and was impacting so heavily on all of us, at that point, it was all over. I don't think that anyone could have defeated Mr. Obama. But at the same time, it was also a referendum, obviously, on Mr. Bush. And the two questions which are always asked about any president are we at peace, and do we enjoy prosperity? And pretty clear at that point that we didn't enjoy much prosperity, quite the reverse, serious crisis. And you know, what kind of peace did we have? Things have gotten certainly better in Iraq, but still there are all kinds of questions. Barack Obama is a colossus bestriding Washington, D.C., which is where I work. Quite a remarkable, we can talk some more about that, quite a remarkable president and man. So I think it was all of those things, George.
Mr. Edwards, you speak about liberty linked to religionism, particularly Christo-Judaism principles in your talk. How does conservatism intend to deal with, or better yet, assimilate the practitioners of the Muslim faith, the birth rate of which is six times greater than that of Christo-Judaism?
Well, I think that's a big, that is a problem, not just for conservatives, but it's for Americans. I think we have to begin by understanding more about Islam, more about Muslims. I think that we don't understand it, we haven't studied it, we don't speak the language, we haven't read the Quran. I mean, there's just a multitude of ignorance about Islam. And if they accept that heritage and understand that is our heritage, and we know that there are millions of Muslim Americans at this point in America, then I see no problem for as a conservative or as an American in welcoming them and having them as part of our population.
Currently, the international population seems to favor liberalism. How does the Conservative Party seem to think they're going to be able to overcome this, and how will this negatively impact the growth of conservatism?
Well, we're in the middle of what I think can properly be called a revolution. I think what's happening in Washington, D.C. right now is a revolution. We haven't seen anything like this in many, many, many years, many decades. And if you try to look historically, well, let's see now, when was the last time we had something so profound, so major in its impact on all of us? And what comes to mind, of course, first of all, is FDR's New Deal back in the 1932-33 when he first initiated it. Then perhaps Lyndon Johnson's Great Society of 1965. And then in its way, I think Ronald Reagan's pushback against government in 1980 and 1981. So I would ask you, of those three radical reforms and proposals, which was successful? Which was successful? Did the New Deal end the Great Depression? Or was there still 15% unemployment by 1937-38? And wasn't it World War II which got us out of the Great Depression, not the New Deal? And did the Great Society solve all the problems which President Johnson promised that it would? Did it end poverty? Did it give education to everybody? Did it bring about a great society? And one of the authors of the Great Society, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, later senator, said, we erred in thinking that we could do all of this through government. And in point of fact, what the Great Society did was to weaken the family and not to help those who were disadvantaged. And something like, in estimates, $5 trillion, $6 trillion spent in trying to do all the things that Mr. Johnson had outlined, and which did not. Which leaves us with the third radical reform, and that is what President Reagan talked about, which was reducing the size of government, not always looking to government to solve our problems. And was it successful? Well, unemployment was cut drastically, inflation was cut, interest rates were cut. We began a period of prosperity for some 20 years. So I would say that historically, it would look to me that maybe, although right now it would seem that liberalism is triumphant, let's see how it plays out. I mean, there's so much being promised right now. Expectations are being raised so high that, you know, I've asked friends of mine, you know, what is the price tag for all of this? And they don't know. Nobody knows. And so in the sorting out, and there are some good ideas which have been proposed by the president. I don't mean to say that everything he's proposed is worthless or useless or dangerous. It's not. But it is in the debate which is going to, has already begun, between Republicans and Democrats, between liberals and conservatives. I think coming out of that, hopefully, will be a far better program than what has been proposed right now. Because if everything that he asked for is passed and becomes law, this will be a far different country than the one we've known for the last 30, 40, 50 years. It is a very, very radical approach to government's role in all of our lives, in my opinion.
What would you say to the argument that the conservative movement's facing a demographic crisis, that it's not that John McCain's coalition, electoral coalition, was any different than Ronald Reagan's or even George Bush's, but simply that it's a smaller slice of the electorate than it was in the past, and that Barack Obama's coalition of racial minorities, young professionals, and young people more generally is sort of the future, the demographic future of the United States. And unless conservatives can react to that, they'll stay in the electoral minority.
Right, right. Well, I think that it's a very good question, but I think what you have to do is not to look at it in terms of where we are in terms of voting blocks, but in terms of the success or the failure of ideas. And the coalition which he is trying to put together, and which did elect him in November, will only stick together as long as what he proposes is in their best interests. And that remains to be seen. And that coalition can come apart very, very, very quickly, depending upon what happens or doesn't happen in the next couple of years, as we see what the price tag is going to be for these programs, as we see, can the federal bureaucracy handle all of these additional responsibilities which is being asked to undertake, whether it's healthcare, whether it's the banks, whether it's automakers. And I'm trying not to be, because it's, you know, well, the people who brought you the post office, do you really want to, you know, look to them to handle all these really important parts of our lives? And I think it's a valid question. We'll just have to wait and see about that.
I wanted to know if you can speak more on the social conservative movement, and because I found that a lot of social conservatives are very decisive. Well, for the Republicans, can be very decisive and a lot of division because of it. And I want to know how it has brought the conservative movement more together, because I find it pushes a lot of moderates away.
Well, you know, politics is, I forget who said this, it was obviously a successful politician. Politics is a matter of addition, not subtraction. And so when somebody says, well, the first thing we have to do is to throw out the social conservatives, you know, that's just silly. I mean, how can you possibly get rid of one of the most important parts of your coalition, the social conservatives? They have been the ground troops for the conservative movement since 1978, when Jerry Falwell founded the Moral Majority. That is not to say that the Moral Majority should run things. It's not to say that they should dictate policy, and they certainly do not in the circles that I'm familiar with. But they are a part of the coalition. And so what you have to have, as I talked about, this idea of the new fusionism, is give and take, checks and balances. So you have social conservatives, economic conservatives, neoconservatives, paleoconservatives, all of them, you know. Come on home. Libertarians, come on home. That's fine. And it can be done. I mean, Ronald Reagan did it. Or he was something of a genius when it came to, he embodied fusionism, the concept, that principle. So that's the reason why we keep talking about it. It's not that the conservatives are sort of, you know, nostalgic about Ronald Reagan. It's because you can look and see what he was able to do concretely, what he was able to accomplish, the kind of political lessons which you can learn from him based upon a sound philosophy.
I wonder if you could tell us something about conservatism in Europe or other developed nations, and whether you see there to be a sort of an essence of conservatism or something they all have in common, or whether American conservatism and each conservatism is a reaction to conditions in that country.
Well, I think that I think that American conservatism is sui generis. Goes back to. And is based on the Constitution, and that's very, very special. There are conservatives in Britain, there are conservatives in France, in Germany, Japan, Korea, I can think of some people, governments in regimes in Eastern Europe as well. But there is not, I think each nation approaches that problem of how to govern separately. And I think the special strength that we have here in America is the Constitution. Now, even though in Eastern Europe, There is not even the former communists, who are now running as socialists or social democrats, are not saying, let's bring back communism. I mean, they're still understanding and I think are supportive for the most part of free market economics with some modification. I think that there's a great deal that can be learned by studying what they're doing. And I would like to see a conservative international in which we could bring perhaps conservatives together and talk and discuss these matters. Chair.
Do you think Social Security and Medicare should be eliminated given it's such a large fraction of the federal budget?
Nor did Ronald Reagan. That's just not, it's not only not realistic, but it's now a part of our fabric. It's a part of our society. People depend upon it. People expect it. Now, one of our problems is at the other end, we have those who, I'm eligible for it. I'm looking forward to it. The problem is among the young people here, and I'm teaching still at Catholic University, and so I'll say to them, and I see some students here, you know, what do you think about it? So, oh, well, we're never going to get any of that. And so that sort of undercuts a very important part of this program. If young people are that skeptical about it, if they're that negative about it, are they going to be willing in future years to help keep it going and provide income for guys like me to be able to get our Social Security? So there's a real education problem which has to go on and explain this is a part of the American fabric, American society, but it cannot keep going on the way it is right now. And I do give Mr. Obama credit for that. He understands that. And there have been discussions not only between conservatives at Heritage, but also at the Brookings Institution. I think you all are familiar with that, you know, center left, maybe slightly liberal. And we have had a number of discussions with them talking about how can we come up with programs to modify and to strengthen Social Security in the long haul. That's what we have to do. We can't eliminate it. That's just not, that would be a cruel thing to do.
Last night, having listened to Jim Lehrer's news program and listening to Judy Woodruff, when she was talking to the budget man for Obama, I was absolutely scared by what I heard. Mm-hmm. And I think she was too, because it was sort of a beginning of a dragging out of class warfare again, a return to the populism that we heard sometimes during the campaign trails. And it really bothered me tremendously. How did you react to something like this?
Well, I think that's part of it. That's part of this radicalization, which I mentioned in my remarks, in which I refer to this as not just reform, which the president has said, but it really is a revolution, if it's carried out to its logical extent. And yes, I do think a lot of it is class warfare. It is trying to bring about divisions between various parts of our society. And it was my understanding, and maybe this should be pointed out to the president, I'm sure it will be, that this is not consistent with what he was talking about, bringing people together. And, you know, we're going to be one nation and one people and so forth. And it's pretty hard to do that when you're talking about singling out a particular class of people and saying, you know, we're going to really tax the you-know-what out of you. So I'm not surprised. I didn't see Judy Woodruff, but I'm not surprised that she would have reacted that way. There is a lot of unease. I can tell you all this. There's a lot of unease in Washington among the media. They haven't quite been able to figure out where this is all going, and also what this is going to cost. What does it mean in terms of additional responsibilities for the government and for the bureaucracy to handle these programs? So it's not only conservatives who are raising these questions, but there are a lot of people who are. And it's going to be up to the president to explain it, to justify it, and we'll see how he does. I mean, he has taken on I think it was Hercules had the impossible tasks and cleaning up the Aegean stables and all the other things that he did. He's taken on this incredible responsibility, and we'll have to see if he's able to do it.
I wonder if you could explain something to me that I don't quite understand about conservatism. I understand conservatism is based upon a philosophy of wanting liberty for all of our citizens, and yet, in practicality, for me, it seems to want to deprive me of freedom to die when and where I would like to die, whether or not to carry a baby if I want to or not, to deprive people of the choice of loving and marrying people that they want. Is the liberty that conservatives actually seek just the right to make a lot of money and keep it, even if that means other people remain poor?
All right. Well, that's a wonderful question, and I thank you for it. And I think we have to go back to the concept that I mentioned in my remarks, and that is of ordered liberty. I think in the broadest sense, conservatism believes in ordered liberty, that you cannot just have unbridled liberty. There has to be a balance there. The question of, for example, of marriage, and the question of same-sex marriage. The conservative position is that perhaps in certain circumstances that, you know, unions are fine, and that if people want to come together who are gay or and they have a legal responsibility and that they want to have endorsed by the state, that would be okay. But if it's talking about marriage, we've looked at this situation and we feel that at this present time, marriage, the family, is under such pressure, under such a danger of perhaps becoming weaker and weaker and weaker, and we know yet that the family is the building block of society, of civilization. And to that extent, we have said, as conservatives, the Heritage Foundation has taken this position, we don't usually get into social issues, that we believe that, yes, same-sex unions, you know, if you want to go that way, that's fine, but not same-sex marriage, because that begins to intrude upon this institution of marriage between a man and a woman. That's the reason why we've taken that position, and that to us is consistent with this idea of ordered liberty. We're certainly for more than just going out and making as much money as you want to. There are plenty of conservatives who are not wealthy, don't have a lot of stocks and bonds, who don't work on Wall Street, and who, as a matter of fact, live in Amarillo, Texas, and Dubuque, and Sacramento, and so forth, far, far away from Wall Street. So I think that we try to, with these basic principles, which I mentioned, to look at each issue on a case-by-case basis. That's about the best I can say.
I'd like to follow up on the woman's comment. It seems to me these positions in regard to the right to die or carry a child and so forth, marriage, are based on conservative idea of religion and government. And I think the founding fathers were quite intentional in making a secular constitution. There's a wonderful little book called The Godless Constitution. And also the First Amendment guarantees not only the right of freedom of religion, but the free exercise thereof. In my church, we exercise that freedom by marrying same-sex people. We leave the right of choice up to the individual, her doctor, and whatever. And I'm sure we take the same position on determining when we have choose to die. So I think that such a position is unconstitutional.
Well, that's a big question. There has been a lot of discussion and examination of it, of just how religious or not religious. For example, were the founders? What did they see as the role of churches? I'd be happy to share with you some literature about that. My colleague, Matt Spaulding, has done quite a bit of work on this. I'd be happy to send that to you. Suffice it to say that the idea of separating of church and state, of course, is not in the Constitution. It's not in the Constitution. It came out of a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote in response to a query sent to him. Now, it's true that the Supreme Court has had certain decisions along the way, but it's not in the Constitution, so I think I have to start with that. Also, that the idea that George Washington was a deist and John Adams was, et cetera, there's quite a bit of literature which shows that there was a very strong belief in God, a belief in divine providence, mention of that in the Declaration of Independence, as you know, if you've got your copy there, which I'm sure you do, and a recognition of that, of the importance of faith and religion in helping to create both private and public virtue. That's an important point so far as conservatives are concerned.
We have time for one final question.
Given that the presidency is intentionally a weak office constitutionally, I'm surprised that you didn't make any reference whatsoever to the congressional role in the last at least two elections and perhaps in the decline of conservatism. And would you like to address that?
Well, it's certainly true that one reason why the Republican Party lost in 2006, lost its majority, and why the Republican candidate lost in 2008, there were other issues there, but both of those losses were due to Congress no longer following conservative principles and conservative ideas and going off into a totally different direction through spending, through increasing the size of government. So that is the reason why what we would say over and over again is that the losses were not based upon conservative ideas or principles, but upon their abandonment. And that's the reason why Republicans lost in 2006 and 2008.
Let me ask everyone to remain in their seats for about 30 seconds to give Lee Edwards the opportunity to get out to where he's going to both sign and sell books and engage in conversation with those of you who would like to chat with him. Please join me in thanking Lee Edwards.